last time we made it down to verse 20. Really kind of pointed out a few things from this, but not getting through it. I'll start there, verse 20 through 26. My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. When you are awake, they will speak with you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. We have looked at this several times. Proverbs 1 through 7 especially goes through the concept of how it is that there is this appeal of adultery, the seduction that takes place there, and how to stay away from that, and the necessity of staying away from that. But as he does normally, Solomon leads into that by pointing out, if you'll concentrate on this, this other is something that you'll be able to overcome. The thing that he's pointing out here is concentrate on what? You keep the father's commandment, the law of your mother. What does that mean? That's just that parallelism, right? It's talking about the same thing. It's a point of emphasis there that you look and you learn from those who go before you. You recognize the need to stay away from this kind of seduction going in the wrong direction. He says you bind those laws or those commands upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. Now, when you look at that, that's another parallel kind of a statement. What's it say? What's the emphasis? Do what? Okay. Always have them with you. Make them a part of you is the idea, not just something you go away from. Sometimes we think of people, they read their Bible, they leave it, and it stays on the shelf where it was. That's not the idea. You take that law, you take that will, and you put it within you. You tie it about you. You let that be something that's always there present. Not in a physical sense, tying that Bible there, but putting those concepts within you. When you roam, then what will happen? They will lead you. But if you leave them back where you heard them and don't make it a part of you, what will happen then? You're not going to be led by those things. You're going to be led by something else. Same thing. When you sleep, they will keep you. When you're awake, they will speak with you. In other words, whether we make them a part of us or not is something that is going to be kind of indicative of whether or not we're going to stay away from these things of evil. We make them a part of us, if it truly is a part of who we are, our thoughts, our cares, our concerns. Then what happens is they tend to inoculate us against those evil. Not saying it makes it impossible. But when you look at the idea of adultery or fornication or much of any other sin for that matter, when one is thinking about God's will and studying on God's will and thinking about the application of that, is that usually the time they take into the sin and start there into those things of wrong? When is it? When they leave those things aside. When they're not thinking about them. But if we think about that, have that there, keep those things as precious to us, then we will recognize they do lead. Why? Because the command is a lamp, the law is a light. And that idea is the reproofs of correction are the way of life. In other words, you just don't go and do anything you want to do. You listen to the Word of God. And its reproofs are a part of those things which are helpful to us to stay away from these evil things. And that's the very point he makes application of, verse 24, to keep you from what? The evil woman who is noted by what? Why a flattering tongue? Surely that wouldn't help any men that were out there to be less than what they should be just because they were flattered. Who listens to flattery? Okay. All right. The kind of one that's the flatterer. How about the flattery, for lack of a better term? Who's willing to be flattered? What? Why is it that people fall for flattery? Do what? All right.
I think everybody wants to feel good about themselves, and when someone tells you, you know, you're pretty or you're good or whatever, you want to hear it.
Yeah.
It's something we all have to find.
All right. That, go ahead.
This should also be a warning to make sure that the things of God fill you up and you feel good about yourself because you're a child of God.
Yeah.
Because when you don't feel good about yourself, you're more susceptible to that flattery and it makes you feel safe. You know, I was just saying really nice to me. And it doesn't feel dangerous and you don't realize the danger is in them.
When you have that flattery and it appeals to one, the basic problem behind that is pride. You get to thinking about it. That's the point. We want to hear something. It doesn't necessarily have to be true. We just want somebody to tell us that it's true, that it's what we would like to hear, what we would like to be so. You know, when you look at what happens all of the time with people who are, I guess you would say, taken in by that flattery. The point being made, we need to have that sufficiency based on being a child of God and the things that are there, that's true. But when there's one that's taken in by the flattery, it's usually as a result of that person having that kind of a desire to be something. They're being flattered not because you're spiritual, you're a wonderful person in a moral sense, all of that. They're being flattered in a realm of this world and something about the nature of this world. I've said several times, I go over to the Philippines. You go in and go to a mall, and every time there's this one that I see, and she comes, "Oh, you are nice looking, the Americans." You know. Well, I mean, I've looked at myself in the mirror. I'm not handsome. I'm not the one that is out there like that. It helps to have a grasp of yourself and a reality that's there, that somebody, if they're trying to build you up, something's not exactly correct here. This isn't according to the facts. But that flatterer is the one who's trying to get something out of this. But the flattery, the one who listens to it, there's also a problem with that one. If he has a basic concept, or she has a basic concept of the facts and reality, and that this is coming not from the standpoint of fact, but it's a kind of a sense of trying to butter them up to get something, then you can keep that flattery from having its effect. But that's what happens. When you look at that taking place out in day-to-day life, if somebody comes along and says, "Oh, my husband, you know, he's this, that, and the other. He doesn't listen to me, but you do." That's the dangerous kind of thing, of those kind of conversations, allowing someone, either the man or the woman or both, to get involved in that kind of thing. Back up. You don't have any business talking about those kind of things with somebody else. What it is trying to make that path a little bit easier for us to let down our guard. Said, "Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids." We don't think of eyelids being a great deal, but what is that? We know that. You ever seen somebody bat their eyes at you? Those little eyelashes. That's the idea. That's there. It's the sense of the seduction again. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. There's a picture in those words. By means of. When there is the use of the harlot by the man, he is reduced to a crust of bread. Now what's she going to do with that crust of bread? Destroy it. Eat it. Those kind of things are going to be one where his precious life is preyed upon. There's a danger in those things, and we need to look at that and be aware of it. Anything further there on that one? Okay. Verse 27. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes in to his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. What's the point that's being made there? There's a question. What's the obvious answer to the question? Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? No. In other words, that's going to have an effect. Then what happens? Can he walk on the hot coals and his feet not be seared? No, that's what happens. There is a result. You have this happen, here's the result that comes along. So what's being learned? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. There are several ways in which that last one is talked about, of shall not be innocent. The literal from the Hebrew is not be held innocent in the sense of punishment. The literal idea is that he will receive, he will not go unpunished. That's the way the American Standard renders it. But the idea is there is a judicial recognition of his lack of innocence, his guiltiness. And as a result of that guilt, then there's a punishment that is incumbent upon him. And so that's the idea. If he follows that path, then that's going to be the result of it. All right, anybody got anything there? Correct. That's right. That's absolutely so. That when you follow this kind of a path, it ends in a destruction there. Anybody else? Okay. Here we go with verse 30 through the end. People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is starving. Yet when he is found, he must restore sevenfold. He may have to give up all the substance of his house. Whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. Wounds and dishonor he will get, and his reproach will not be wiped away. For jealousy is a man's fury, is a husband's fury. Therefore, he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will accept no recompense, nor will he be appeased, though you give him many gifts. When someone sinned against the wife or the child of another, what did the Old Testament law provide for? How was the taking of vengeance done? Do what? All right. The one who was next of kin was the one who took the lead in bringing about that punishment or doing what was according to the law. That was what the law provided for. That assured that that punishment would take place, not be lost in the crowd. And so he says, here you have somebody who's a thief. If he stole to satisfy his own hunger, do people recognize that? Is there an understanding that to some degree you say, well, I understand why he did it. Yeah. Does that make it right? No. And so what has to happen? When he steals, even though he's starving to feed himself, what has to happen? There's justice that has to be meted out. There has to be a penalty for that. It's still wrong, even though he was one who was doing it for his own or his own life. Now, if that's so, then here's somebody who's doing it to survive, to get by. If he has to, in the end, pay the penalty, he has to pay the effects of that wrong. How about the one who takes his neighbor's wife? Did he have to do that? Did that sustain his life? No. He did that out of his own desire. He should not have. He should have been satisfied with the wife of his youth, like we talked about last time. But instead, he does that. Now, when he commits adultery with a woman, what's going to happen to him? Destroys his own soul. Now, is that talking about the kind of punishment that is meted out to him by the family or by a judicial process? No. And that's where Solomon's point stands here. First, he needs to recognize what he does is he brings himself to death. He's one who causes the death of his own soul. He destroys it. Why? Because now he's in sin. And he comes under the condemnation of God. That he did to himself. He said, wounds of dishonor will he get. Why? Why will he get wounds and dishonor? Where's that come from?
Well, it's an extremely dishonorable thing he did.
Okay. The dishonor is because he's looked at by others and recognized for that shame. Wounds. What'd that family do to him? All right. There's an angry husband that's involved here, and that's the point that's going to be there. He's going to get those physical stripes, which were also a responsibility in that, really, that he be stoned to death. And his reproach will not be wiped away. Why? Because the jealousy of a husband's fury is one that will not spare in the day of vengeance. In other words, that husband who's been brought to a shame by a wife that is an adulteress, and one taken from him, as this adulterer has done, since that one is now responsible for the penalty to be paid in the sense of the penalty before law, especially the stoning to death, is he going to be one who will forego that? No. In his mind, that guy's worthy of it. And the vengeance will not be spared in that day. That was the responsibility that was laid upon him by the old law. He will accept no recompense, nor will he be appeased, though you give him many gifts. Take that back to the case of the man who stole from this fellow. Let's say he stole because he was starving. And now he's caught, and this man is going to mete out the judgment that is there. Do you think if he heard from that thief, well, I stole, I'm sorry I did that, I was starving to death, that's why I hadn't eaten in 3 days, whatever else was there, and I shouldn't have done it. What do you think that guy who was stolen from might be ready to do? All right, he might be ready to show mercy. That was perfectly permissible under the Old Testament law. He could show that mercy, that one who was responsible to mete out the judgment. Do you think that man, if his wife has been taken by this person and he's committed that kind of theft and adultery, is he ready to be easily over that problem? He's not going to be appeased in that. There's going to be a full judgment that is to be made. That's of a different kind. All right? Anybody got anything? Go ahead.
Well, when you read Proverbs, as you're younger, it's the same application for everybody. But when you're younger, you're reading it one way because you're the son listening to your father. Older and you read it and you're like, I don't have a father anymore. Am I teaching this to my son? And there's many ways of doing this. I mean, obviously, everybody knows they shouldn't be running around with everybody's wife, but it doesn't keep them from doing it, you know. And do they see, what do they see in you? Do they see you linger at the commercials, you know, that have half-naked women on them? Do they see you staring too long at the lady in the mall? You know, I mean, it starts, we have to teach this to our kids.
Right.
We have to set the example ourselves, you know, that that's not right. And the way you keep from it, it tells you to bind it around your neck. Well, when you're binding something around your neck, maybe you're not doing the act of adultery with somebody, but you're sure doing it with your eyes. And your kids see that, you know. So I mean, there's a lot, you know, just as my son, you
right.
know. So we need to make sure we're teaching this stuff at home.
Absolutely.
Not just letting the Bible teach it to our kids.
A lot of times I think we're somewhat hesitant to talk about it because of the subject, and it's hard to raise. But the fact of it is, it's being raised. And either we're going to meet that challenge by putting a correct representation on how that is to be met properly, or it's the world that's doing the teaching on that. Go ahead.
So, to add what Scott said, then, not only do they need to make sure they don't see us doing those things, they need to see us then. Do we treat our spouse like a queen or a king? Do we put them on a pedestal? Do we look at them with a gleam in our eyes still, as we've read in the passages here, and that we're treating them with love and respect? Do they see us apologize when we raise our voice or do something inappropriate or do something wrong? And so to see those positive interactions with and as a husband and wife is so very important.
Right. When we talk about it, when I'm talking to people about their lives before they enter marriage, there's a lot of times we'll have a lesson on adultery-proofing your marriage. And it's not just a matter of saying, I don't want to do that. Make it to where there are balances and checks around how you can't possibly get by with it. You know, our upfront nature on finances and various things like that, when we do that, it makes it something that is not going to be an easy matter to do whatever if we'll make sure everything's accounted for all of the time and all of these other ways, our time and so forth. That needs to be something that they see in us as well, that we're doing everything we can to avoid those sins. Anybody else?
Harry, I would just add too, is that I love how you said that, to say before you get married, here's how we're going to be, here's what we're going to do. I would add to that, divorce is not an option.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we'll cover that subject too there. All right. What does it mean to become surety for one's neighbor? Going over chapter 6 here. Okay. Somebody who's a guarantee in a financial sense there. How is the ant a good example for the sluggard to observe? What's so about an ant? All right. Industrious, going all of the time in that kind of a way. What is meant by poverty comes as a robber, and want is an armed man upon the sluggard? What's meant by that? Anybody?
It seems to come out of nowhere, and there's not anything that you can do about it at that point.
Okay. It's an inevitable that's there. The idea that it's something that is going to be devastating. There's going to be a kind of a destructive thing that comes upon you. In God's eyes, is sowing discord among brethren hated less than murder? Why? Okay. These six things the Lord hates, seven are abomination to Him. And they're in the same category. They're involved in much of the same things. In fact, if you go back and look at it, some of that is involved in principle in both, or what caused those two to come along. Beware, flattery may come from an immoral woman, or some have the word seductress there. What is lost that is precious when one commits adultery? Do what? I couldn't hear. Oh, the soul. Okay. What else? Is honor lost?
Reputation.
There are several things that he goes through in that section there in chapter 6. Why is the consequence of adultery more demanding in its punishment than that of a thief?
Thief can generally pay back with the same.
Okay. He can restore, and it will be brought back in that way, sometimes, as the law talks about, several fold, depending on the situation. That can't ever be done with regard to adultery. Do you have anything?
Well, I was going to say, theft only involves a few people, but adultery can involve a lot.
Yeah. There's going to be, people hurt by that all around. Okay, let's go to chapter 7 then. First five verses. My son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. Keep my commands and live, and my law as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. Now, right after this, we're going to get involved right back into that idea of the beware of that seductress and so forth. But here you have the same thing we did at the first of this evening. You have principles that are there. Listen to this. If you keep your mind on this, it'll keep you from the other. And so what does he tell? My son, notice the singular so that he zooms in on it. There's an emphasis now to this and a kind of a one-on-one conversation. Keep my words and treasure my commands where? Within you. What's that like that we studied at the start? Bind them around your neck, put them in your life, all of those kind of things. In other words, this isn't just something you keep distance from after you've studied a little bit. He said, keep my commandments and live, and my laws as the apple of your eye. Not only keep them, but what does that mean to have them as the apple of your eye?
Very important.
Okay. This is something that is your desire that is there before you. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablets of your heart. Look what we got. Different body parts now having it within them. It's a part of this person again. Say to wisdom what? You're my sister. What in the world? What is that talking about? To wisdom, you're my sister. How do you treat your sister? Do what?
A close relative.
Okay. All right, there's a specialness there, and that the tenderness there between a boy and his sister. I think about my relationship with my sister Carolyn. I'd give anything to have her back. It's that sense of there's that kind of you're part of each other in a way that you've always known that person. They're one that you kind of depended on. There's a closeness that's there. And he says, you're my sister. Call understanding your next of kin or your nearest kin. So what does that equate to? we did that, that would be having that kind of a special place of wisdom and understanding. Putting it as something that we have near and dear to us, that we cherish and hold on to. And so that is the idea of how we look at that wisdom and understanding. Now, what will that do? That they may do what? How do wisdom and understanding keep one from the immoral woman, or the other reverse of that, the immoral man?
Instead of seeing their words as flattering, you can see the trap that they're laying out for you. So you're not naive and you're not susceptible to that trap. You can see those flattering words as the trap.
Wasn't born yesterday. I know where this is headed, kind of thing. Somebody have it.
But also, you make better decisions of where you go when you see that it happened before you get there. You know, I'll need to be in that situation. I'll need to be in that area.
That's the point. You recognize the kind of a sense of I'm going to use my intellect, my knowledge of things, my understanding of what happens, and there are places that I'm going to stay away from. I'm not even going to get close to that situation. It's not that I'll have to say no to it when it happens. If I know that that's headed in that direction, wait a minute, turn around, go the other way. And we're going to talk about that here just a little bit. Anything? Go ahead.
Well, we read this, you know, thinking of a harlot on a street corner, but it's the lady you work with or the neighbor down the street, you know, it means somebody you're comfortable with, and that's how they can get to start flattering you and all that. And that's how you have to be on guard.
That's right.
You know, it's not, obviously, if a prostitute or someone's walking up to you, you know, I shouldn't be here, you know, but it's other instances that can happen that you have to be well aware of.
Raymond, go ahead. When you look at the biblical world, it was full of this, with even, like we had said before, temple prostitution and many other ways as well. That was just something that was common. And it's something that you see not only in the New Testament, but you also see it in the Old Testament. There's not a time when adultery and fornication have not been a problem. It's always been a problem. Go ahead.
Besides these great, fantastic admonitions here in this chapter, you also have the real life example of Joseph in the Bible. And you can see that parallel of what Joseph did and what he did do.
That's right.
And these things what he did. So.
All right. And David and Bathsheba and several others that we can look at. All right, now, verse 6. For at the window of my house, I looked through my lattice, and I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner, and he took the path to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night, there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. Where do you see the problem?
He's out late at night in the darkness.
Wonder why?
Yeah, he's looking.
It's done in the darkness. Why? People don't shame. They want to hide it. And so there's this place out there. He's walking along, and somebody's looking at him. And he's got that look that he's headed the wrong direction, is the obvious point. I look through the lattice, and what I see? Those words simple mean there. Does that mean easy?
Void of understanding.
All right. Void of understanding. He's not bright. He's not using his head. Saw the simple man perceived among the youth, a young man devoid of understanding. He has that appearance. He's out there looking, not recognizing what he's about to have happen to him. Now, as he passes, he goes by the corner and he takes the path that goes to her house. Why did he do that? Go see.
Now look, I don't really intend to go in that house, but he's putting himself in harm's way.
There's a picture here of the kind of thing where everybody knows what's there. And he's going that direction. He's going in that way. Go ahead, Steve. That's right.
That's the key. That's where it all starts.
That's right.
And it's going to be harder for some men than others. There'll be other issues that some others will have than this, but it shows that we have a choice and that we've got to make that choice that not when you see the one look coming down the street looking at you, but you already have made that covenant with your eyes.
That's right.
When I'm reading this in the void of understanding, I'm getting the idea that this young man has no idea where he's headed, and that he's not prepared for that possibility.
I don't think that he doesn't have an idea what's there, or he wouldn't go the path to that place. He's going there for that purpose. The idea in which he's void of understanding is with a lot of other. They think, well, there can't be any real harm in this. He's talked himself into that, and he's not recognizing. We have a statement sometimes that sin takes us farther than we ever thought, and it costs us more than we ever intended. And that's the idea that's here. This one lacking in an understanding, lacking in seeing what's going to be the result of this, just goes out there and comes along that path in the twilight, the evening, the black, dark night. Maybe nobody will see me. Now what happens? There a woman met him in the attire of a harlot. He went to a place he shouldn't have. He didn't use his head, didn't use his understanding and wisdom. And as a result, now, where does he find himself? Finds himself in the problem that's there and the results that will come. Go ahead.
I think maybe a better rendering of that statement would be, did not use wisdom.
Yeah.
He did not use the wisdom that he had given.
Correct. He's not thinking through. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else got anything there? Okay, I want to get through this next part. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times, she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him with an impudent face. She said to him, I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vows. So I came out to meet you, diligent to seek your face, and I have found you. Now it's going to go on with what she's saying a little bit after this. But I want to stop here for just a second. Contrast that with another passage to me. She was loud and rebellious. Here's the nature of this immoral woman. Okay. 1 Peter chapter 3. That which God desires is a meek and quiet spirit. Here was a woman who's boisterous. She's out front. She's brash. Is a way that you can use that word loud. It probably would be the word brash that we would talk about from there. There's not a sense of propriety there. Now, what did she do? Her feet won't stay at home. In other words, she's out searching all the time. She's looking for that prey. And she's outside at times in the open square. She's lurking at every corner. Now what does she see? She sees this guy. She catches him. She kissed him. With an impudent face, she said to him, what does that mean? What's an impudent face?
Without shame.
Okay. That kind of a hardened, steeled kind of a sense of that lacking of shame or lacking of propriety. Now, this is one that you need to think about. Because when you look at this statement, I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vow. Why does she talk about I have peace offerings with me and I've paid my vow? How does that go with her plan toward adultery? I've done these religious things, so, you said. Go ahead.
The 11 and 12, I just went over Proverbs 31, and it's opposite the things that she's busying herself
okay.
with. And the things that are a description of a worthy woman.
Okay.
Completely opposite.
Yeah, good contrast there. With this idea of the peace offerings, she says, look, I've just done my religious duty here. I've got everything finished there, so why don't you come home with me? Does that strike you as odd? Could be that. What else?
I always look at self-justification. Justifying the things I've done. I've done this so I can do this.
Okay. And there's a kind of an idea. Well, I just did some good. Surely this won't harm me too bad. What else? Go ahead.
I think that her goal is to make herself more, whether you say, well,
a totally bad girl. Yeah.
Religious, some type of religious values. That
all right. Do you ever notice the fact that when David committed adultery with Bathsheba, he found her and waited until she had come past the time of her impurity during the monthly cycle that was there? It was forbidden to be involved in that way. So now he waits until she's past the time of that impurity. You notice several times those kind of things being looked at of some religious element being brought out there. You know, I see that many times with people who give themselves to adultery. But, well, I've done this, and I'm a religious person. I'm surely God's accepting me. This isn't so bad. You know, this one little thing over here. And they talk themselves into something to where this has devalued this sin. It's not so bad. It's a little bit easier to deal with at this point. I saw it. Go ahead, Jason. And I've seen that over and over again happen with those who are religiously minded and even leaders sometimes among God's people, that there is that trap that they get into of the adultery. They're out here trying to help someone, and so while they're helping someone, they get their guard that's pushed down little by little by little, and before long, what happens? Their guard isn't there the way it needs to be, and they commit the sin. We need to remember something. Adultery and fornication are not just a problem for the next guy and the next woman. They're a problem that we have to look at for all of us. There's a temptation that will be there given the situation, the circumstance that would be there. We don't ever need to say, hey, I just wouldn't do that. I never would. That can't possibly be me. If you say that, I tell you what, for long, you're probably going to be guilty. That always is something that needs to be watched. This is a sin that has taken many people. If it's taken Solomon and David, I better think about it. If I think I'm not possible of being guilty of that, I better back up and look at myself real quick, because that is a danger for all of us. Anybody else there? Okay, if not, we're going to end right there, and then we'll finish this up going through the rest of chapter 7, finish those questions, if you will. Rick White, will you lead us in a closing word of prayer, then we'll be dismissed.